Hey guys, back on the Line Drive podcast, Hogan Gidley and Kalen Doerr. I'm Tim Murtaugh. And guys, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Timothy.
As always, my best friend. It's good to see you.
Good to see you. I'm sorry to report that Sunny Joy Nelson is not with us. She's getting close to coming back, though. Young Isaiah is apparently taking the bottle, and she'll be back anytime. So that's good news. But I think the even better news, and I'm sorry that Sunny is going to miss this, is who is, in fact, with us today. And this is fantastic. It's going to be, I think, a really great show. And what else would you expect? Because this is the Line Drive podcast. With that, we welcome to the program the great Congresswoman from the great state of Wyoming, Harriet Hageman. Harriet, thank you so much.
Just a clap for her, I think. I think she deserves some clapping.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's lovely to be with you on this gorgeous fall day.
Yeah, I would note that no guest has gotten a round of applause either before or after the appearance.
Normally, Hogan just makes us clap for him. So
that's true.
A good change Hogan. Of pace.
And he's looking at Hogan put on a tie for you, Harriet.
Right.
I'm appreciative.
Yeah, well, that's really good.
It was the anti-Fetterman attire. You see how Kalen and Tim embraced the wardrobe.
No, that's not true.
It's rather stunning how one individual can so dramatically, I guess, destroy the culture and so quickly.
She's talking about you, Kalen.
I was going to say, I'm embracing it fully. I hope everywhere does this. I'm not going to belabor the podcast any longer, but if you think I'm not rocking gym shorts everywhere I go from now on, you got another thing coming.
Yeah.
Kalen, the hoodie is the only thing that was preventing Kalen from running for Senate. Now I expect to see.
And now he's in.
Senate 2024. Mm-hmm. Kalen's
right. You guys go pick a state. I'll move there and run.
That's excellent. For the record, I'm not wearing a hoodie. I'm wearing a yellow polo, got like a golf shirt. So, and Kalen is wearing some kind of zip up. It looks like it could be like a half hoodie, something like that. But anyway, let's not get bogged down in that. Harry, I feel like I need to disclose that the firm where I work, National Public Affairs, Congresswoman Hageman is a client, and I also myself was a consultant on her race in 2022 when she rather handily dispatched former Congresswoman Liz Cheney in the Republican primary and then cruised to a very, very sizable victory in the general election. And so congratulations on that for knocking off Liz Cheney. That was a great race.
Thank you for your help. I couldn't have done it without you, Tim.
Well, I happen to know that that's not true. I happen to know that that's not true. That you absolutely would have done it without me anyway. So, but I was glad to be there and happy to be along for the ride. And one of those things that happened on that ride was really one of the great stories. You know, like we knew, you knew, and we knew what was happening, and I'm sure Liz Cheney knew what was happening in Wyoming, that the ground had shifted underneath her, and you were coming for her. You were going after her hard, and you were going to win. And we feel like we knew that early on, but nobody in the media had ever really reported that. And then the New York Times contacted us and said that they wanted to go out to Wyoming to cover the race because it was a high profile thing with Liz Cheney and all that and her opposition to Donald Trump. And Reed Epstein, who's a reporter that I know and I'm friendly with, and I imagine everybody here knows, he said he wanted to go out there. And so we had to decide, all right, what level of cooperation are we going to give the New York Times when they show up in Wyoming and want to cover this race? You don't trust the New York Times, but I know Reed Epstein is a decent guy. And you volunteered to do something when the New York Times was in town. I'll let you tell it, Harriet. What did you decide would be a good idea when Reed Epstein came to town?
Well, so we were going to have to meet with him on a Saturday morning if we were going to do an in-person interview. And I said, well, if we're going to meet with him on a Saturday morning, I'll just cook him breakfast. So he came to my house. You came out. My sister Rachel was there, my husband. And you came, and also my campaign manager. And we first had breakfast and then had an opportunity to do the interview after that.
Do you remember what you made him for breakfast?
Yeah, what did you make?
I remember. I know.
Go ahead, Tim.
Oh, you said. I want to know if you remember.
I think I made a quiche. I think that it was first of all, I love to cook. And I like to cook for people. And I think that it actually very much disarmed him. It just in terms of how we interacted with it.
Yeah, I think it was a sausage quiche by my recollection. And I think it did. And right there in your house, and, you know, our game plan was like, you know, it's going to be hard for him to be that tough in an interview when you're sitting there eating quiche in your house, right, in your dining room. And, you know, Reed is a fair guy. He asked the appropriately difficult questions. But what we got out of that is and he just reported what was happening on the ground. He just saw what was really happening. And that was there was a surge behind your candidacy. Liz Cheney was in deep, deep trouble. And in February of the election year, 2022, that's 9 months before the election, the New York Times wrote a story basically that Liz Cheney was in serious, serious trouble. And it was the first news outlet to write that story. And it changed the way the whole media looked at it. When the New York Times said, hey, y'all ought to check what's happening here, everyone else. Oop, Liz Cheney's in serious trouble. And so did you feel a difference in the media from that point forward after that?
There was definitely the interest in the race just simply because of the fact that of who she is, not because of who I was. But what it did is I think that it did put me on a different level. I think that there was some question as to whether I was a serious candidate. He was more willing to go into my background and my history and the work that I had done, the work that I've done for the state of Wyoming. My family, my regard for the state of Wyoming, and the fact that I really spoke for Wyomingites, whereas Liz Cheney was clearly a swamp creature. And I think that there was just such a huge contrast between us that it generated additional interest in the race, but it also, I think that it did put me in a position where I was very much more of a serious candidate, or at least the more national media was willing to admit that.
And you guys want to jump in here anytime, Hogan and Kalen, but or I can keep going.
I've got a very important question, Congresswoman. How many pancakes do you think Tim Murtaugh can eat in one sitting?
Oh, come on.
Well, I have had the good fortune of cooking for Tim a couple of times.
Right.
Yeah, a couple of times.
So
yeah.
I don't know that I can answer that, but he's always been a gentleman while he's been in our house.
Well, yeah, not a big fat slob like somebody on this screen. Yeah.
Don't talk about Hogan that way. That's rude. Yeah.
My gosh.
If I knew quiche was so powerful, I think I would have had one in the White House every morning. Just
get every morning.
To reporters, for the people that hated it so much. Congresswoman, do you find, I mean, obviously the national media is kind of worthless, but do you find there are folks locally you can talk to? One of my big pushes with candidates and also with kind of our messaging when we're talking about national issues is to take it local. Do you find that you have a fair shake with the press in Wyoming, or is it just like every other press entity or core where they're just out to get you at every turn?
It really depends on which one it is. The Casper Star Tribune and I do not have a very solid relationship, but we never have. Prior to running for office, I was a very active water and natural resource attorney in Wyoming and handled quite a few extremely important cases and pretty high profile cases in Wyoming. So I've had an opportunity to interact with the press long before I was ever involved in the political side. There are some publications that they definitely will run my work and they give me a fair shot and they give me an opportunity to comment and respond. So I think that the media is changing, and I think that it's correct to differentiate between local media and national media. And I think it's fair to differentiate between your CNNs of the world and MSNBCs and kind of the insurgent media that is coming out with podcasts like yours. We no longer have to rely solely on the big three as we used to. You know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s where you had Walter Cronkite and not much else. Now that's not the case. We can get legitimate news out there.
Yeah, Cowboy State Daily is one who, you know, we don't love everything that they do, but they're a prominent news source now. And I guess you would call them an upstart, right? They wouldn't be considered legacy media at all. It's a website-driven publication.
They have been fantastic in terms of running my editorials and typically on the issues that are important to Wyoming that have a federal nexus, they definitely reach out to my office and we interact with them. And it's a good working relationship. They're much more fact-based than some of the other media that you see, and I appreciate that.
You mentioned the people of your state and the issues that they care about that, you know, are federal and also local. Of course, they overlap there. Talk about some of the issues that are most important to the folks in your state.
I can tell you what we're hearing right now is inflation is truly crushing people. And why that's so important to Wyoming is it's not merely the impact that it's having on their pocketbook, but many of them are employed in the energy industries or industries that are supported by the energy industry. We're the largest coal producer in the nation. We're one of the top oil and gas producers in the nation. We have one of the highest quality reserves of uranium in the nation. So we have the ability to energize this country, and we have for decades. I believe last year we produced 250 million tons of coal. The next closest was West Virginia, and they were at 125 million. Literally, we are 100% more than what they produce every year. Wow. Our coal is very clean. It's accessible. It's affordable. And that's why we have had the prosperity in this country that we have for the last 100 years is affordable energy. And the moment that you change that, input, you affect everything else. The price of a chair can go up. It's not going to have an impact on what carrots cost. But when energy goes up, carrots become more expensive. And what I think people need to truly understand about this is intentional. What they realized, what they being the environmental groups of the Democrats realized probably 4, 5, 6 years ago, was that they're never going to bring down the cost of solar and wind. Their so-called renewables, I refer to them as the unreliables. They're never going to bring down the cost of unreliables that they could actually compete financially against coal and oil and gas. So they made a policy decision to adopt policies to increase the cost of coal and oil and gas. And then they can turn around and say, see, solar and wind, they're cost competitive. That's perfectly appropriate, but it's only done through massive amounts of subsidies and on the unreliables, and then also so dramatically limiting our access to coal and oil and gas and uranium.
Now, let me ask you. So obviously, Wyoming's a much different state than all 49 others, right? Are you finding, since you are a first term congresswoman, are you finding that people are coming to you and offering to be champions for some of these causes? Are you finding that there's unification on some of these things? If I'm just stumbling upon this podcast, for example, and I'm looking for more conservative champions to follow, who are kind of some of the people who are helping you out? Who are the ones that are really helping Wyomingites and all that stuff?
One of the things that I feel very fortunate about in Congress is that I work with people who understand that area of my expertise. And I have some very strong support throughout the conference, throughout the Republican conference, when these issues come up, because all of their citizens are being crushed by inflation as well. The Republicans understand the relationship between affordable energy and a prosperous society. We get it. And so as we have been pushing forward with these things, I would say the entire conference supports every effort that we make to push forward with affordable energy. So I'm just going to say across the board, people are very supportive of what I've been trying to do. I introduced the Coal Act, and what the Coal Act would do would be require the Secretary of Interior to start leasing coal again. And then I've also been actively involved on some oil and gas bills. Our Native American tribes, such as the Navajo, they have very extensive oil and gas assets. They're extremely unhappy with Deb Haaland, at least some of the leadership is. They own one of our coal mines in Wyoming, and they're terribly unhappy with the policies that are coming out of this administration that will keep their citizens, their tribal members, in abject poverty. So I think people who have any kind of sense at all recognize what the issue is. They're willing to fight on these things, and they've definitely supported the efforts that I've made. H.R. 1 was our most important bill as a conference that we submitted this year that we passed out. And it is one of the very best energy security bills in the history of energy policy bills that we have ever issued in Congress. So I think that gives you an idea of how important this priority is. Our HR 2 is border security, and it's the very best border security bill that's ever been passed by Congress.
I want to talk about the border security stuff in a second, but you're the news this week, you're on the House Judiciary Committee, which apparently is the place to be in Washington these days. You had the Attorney General Merrick Garland before your panel earlier this week, and you gave, I'm going to play one of your questions here to him. You gave him a pretty good grilling. What did the New York Post say about your performance there in that committee? What did they say?
I don't remember.
You don't remember? Okay. When I bumped into you, then
I love that.
I'll find it. Hang on a second. So here's a clip.
Willing to pay the taxes on those ill-gotten gains. What would the typical penalty have been, for example, if it was someone who didn't have the last name of Biden or a D behind their name?
I'm sorry. These are all questions you'll have to direct to Mr. Weiss, and Mr. Weiss will address in his final.
By allowing the statute of limitations to lapse, did Mr. Weiss effectively gift the tax money Hunter Biden owed for the 2014 and 2015 tax years to Mr. Biden?
To say again, the decisions about whether in this area and whether these allegations are correct are ones that Mr. Weiss will be able to answer.
Okay, that's a little herky jerky, but the point is, you were getting at the they let the statute of limitations lapse on the tax violations for Hunter Biden, and you're saying, you know, they're gifting the money, but also taking that a step further is they apparently intentionally cut off their own avenue to investigate one of the crimes that leads directly to Joe Biden.
That's
that
right.
And so what did Merrick Garland clear anything up for you the other
no,
day?
No, Merrick Garland, number one, was a terrible witness. Number two, I have the very best seat in the House on the Judiciary Committee. I sit right directly in front of the witness. And so the witness kind of has to sit there and stare down with me during much of the hearing if they ever look at me, and they tend to try to avoid that. But I've got a direct line of communication with them, and you could tell which questions really made him nervous. His voice would shake, his hands would shake. He did not have a poker face. But the point is that just on one of the paychecks that Hunter Biden took from Burisma, which was about $1 million, he would have owed roughly $400,000 in taxes. By allowing that statute of limitations to lapse, they didn't get that $400,000. But again, they also didn't get the penalty. You owe $400,000 to the IRS and fail to pay it. Keep in mind, there are very steep penalties associated with that as well. But the other thing that they did by allowing those 2 years to lapse, that was one of the direct connections with Joe Biden's payments. And so they keep saying, there's no evidence that Joe took the money. Well, first of all, that's not a standard that we're going to have to show. His son is engaging in nefarious acts with foreign governments, foreign countries, foreign businesses. But the IRS whistleblowers have come out. They've made it very clear that this was an extremely unusual type of investigation, and that anytime there was an effort to kind of draw that line between Hunter Biden and Joe Biden, they got their little fingers slammed in the piano cover, if you will. They weren't allowed to go down that road. And Merrick Garland is part of that cover up. But keep in mind, you know, that happened while he was vice president. So you've got the graft associated with it, the bribery associated with it. But the question also becomes, to what extent is our foreign policy being dictated by the actions of Hunter Biden? You know, the Chinese spy balloon that was allowed to traverse our entire country, including over the state of Wyoming. What we're paying for Ukraine, we're at over $100 billion shoving money into that country with no explanation to the American people as to what victory looks like or what our end goal is. And there are just so many things that are happening right now, and all of them kind of lead back to Hunter Biden and the activities that he's taken over the last 20 years.
I found it in the New York Post here, by the way. It's Miranda Devine, who, by the way, has also been a guest on the show. And she said that you wiped the smirk off of Mr. Garland's face, just so you know.
He, at one point, if you listen to that 5 minutes of questioning, because that's all I get is 5 minutes, at one point you will start hearing his voice change. And that is the point where he's kind of flipping out as to how do I get out of this?
Yeah. It was so egregious. Like, just listening to him, his voice, he was so smarmy during the whole thing. I felt that the smoker's voice was enough to wear me out anyway. But I felt as though he felt like the entire, I felt as though he felt the entire thing was beneath him. It was almost like it was a chore for him to come up there and take these serious questions, and it matters to the future of the country. But as I've said many times, when the legacy media, the big three, as you just point out, cover Hunter and Joe 0 minutes from June 8th to July 18th, and they spend 527 minutes on Donald Trump, it's tough because it's that when a tree falls in the forest type thing.
Uh-huh.
What can you do? And again, I argue a lot of this is local, but what can you do to kind of let people understand that this no evidence narrative the left is pushing is such a joke? And I'll just make this one point, and I'll let you answer. It's, you know, if I walk into a room and I have blood all over my shirt and I'm holding a handgun, it's smoking, and I've got bloody fingerprints all over it, it's circumstantial evidence. You have no idea what I did with that gun, but there's a good chance that if there's someone dead in the next room, I may be connected to it. All of these things are clearly showing a potential link between Hunter and Joe. Why does no one in the media acknowledge that? And what can you do to kind of help them get the picture?
One of the things that will happen with the impeachment inquiry is that they're not going to be able to ignore it for much longer. So again, I believe that people like you are filling the gap. And so people know, the American public knows that something's up. They know that we have a doddering fool in the White House who is suffering from pretty severe dementia. We all know it. I mean, that's not hidden. So people are curious, okay, well, who's running our country? And then you've got this, again, to use the word, this idea of deflection. They want to deflect things. But the American public is too smart for that. So I think the information is getting out there. But once we start doing, or once we are doing, while we are doing the impeachment inquiries, they're not going to be able to ignore it. The thing that does is it gives us additional powers for subpoenas, issuing subpoena to people, as well as to documents. Right now, the National Archives is withholding over 5,000 emails that Joe Biden used a pseudonym. We have seen some of those emails, and they demonstrate that he used a pseudonym with official correspondence where Hunter Biden was copied on topics related to Ukraine. So the other point that I keep making about all of this is that Hunter Biden was an admitted raging crackhead from 2003 to 2019, which is the very period of time at issue here, 2003 to 2019. Hunter Biden had no assets to sell. Hunter Biden had no skill set to sell. I was a water attorney. You want to talk about water quantity or water quality issues in Wyoming? I can sit down and we can spend 7 hours and I can help you get a water right, blah, blah, blah. He was not an expert on Ukrainian employment law. He was not an expert on import-export of oil and gas facilities. He had no expertise for being on the board of Burisma. His only asset was Joe Biden, and everybody knows that. So yes, you say there's circumstantial evidence. The circumstantial evidence, in my opinion, is quite overwhelming. There's over 20 sham companies, LLCs, that they put together where they just poured money from one LLC into another LLC, into another LLC, and then they would pay almost a dozen Bidens. What were those Bidens doing to get millions of dollars out of these sham LLCs to continue with their lifestyle? I mean, again, this is a pretty unimpressive family, not a lot of skills. And Joe Biden has just failed upwards for 50 years because he's an empty vessel that people can control. And so I think that the evidence will be there. I think it is there.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the thing. When they say, well, a lot of the times the media will say, well, there's no link, that you can't prove that Joe Biden himself received any benefit from any of this money. Now, hold on a second. You have a dozen members of his family, including grandchildren, getting millions of dollars, a total of $20 million being pumped into all of the people who are closest to him in his life. And you're telling me that he is receiving no benefit? His entire family is getting rich. That's not a benefit to him as the patriarch?
Tim, you absolutely hit it on the head. It is such an absurdity. But it goes really, people use the word hypocrisy and double standard. And I dislike both of those words because what it does is, again, allows people to deflect attention from what we're really talking about.
Right.
One of the things that sets our country apart from so many others is we have equal application of the law. We have the rule of law. We have equal, we have the equal protection clause. Why this is so frustrating and why this is so dangerous is I believe one of the biggest threats to our republic is when you start treating people differently based upon their political association, their political proclivities, their beliefs. You can, and that's why I asked that question the way I did, Tim. What would the penalty have been for somebody who doesn't have the last name of Biden or a D behind their name? Because that is going to destroy our republic. Those kinds of actions will destroy our republic. And it, going back to Liz Cheney, in fact, that's what I said to her in the debate. During our debate, she said, Donald Trump is the biggest threat to our democracy. And I said, well, first of all, we're not a democracy. Then maybe that's your problem. You don't get that. But second of all, that isn't the biggest threat to our republic. An unequal application of the law is. We're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes and penalties that should have been paid by Hunter Biden, and they weren't, because the law is being used by people like Merrick Garland, Weiss, the head of the FBI, and these people to shield them. And that's going to destroy the foundation of this country.
No question. I love the way you phrased that question. It really was good to him, because you kind of obviously made it a pregnant question, if you will. There was no room for him to wiggle out of that. I do have to run real quickly, but I just want to tell you how much I appreciate it. It's so nice talking to you. And I remember during the campaign, you actually called me and we talked for a minute, and you were telling me what you were going to do in the race. I know you called the bajillion people, don't remember it, but it was a really good conversation. I remember, gosh, this person has a shot here. I was really impressed with the conversation. So thank you very much. And for Kaylin, just so you know, when she was comparing a chair to a carrot is a vegetable that's orange, it grows in the ground. And people eat them on things like salads, which basically is a bunch of lettuce. You know,
They put that in like lo mein and fried rice. Yeah, I'm familiar.
Yeah, you will have to define what a salad is for Kaylin.
Yeah, that's right.
So Hogan has to go in mid-show here because he has a TV hit and he's super fancy. Harry, and there he goes. He's gone now. So
finally, let our hair down.
Yeah, now finally, Kaylin can get a word in. You mentioned the impeachment inquiry, which is very important, and that yet again, the House Judiciary Committee has a piece of that. It's one of the committees that's going to be involved in the impeachment inquiry. And how important is just that word? I think a lot of the media and a lot of probably regular Americans, when they heard, impeachment, they think what they saw during the Trump two twin impeachments there, which were strictly political. But the word inquiry is very important because the media, first they deny that there's any evidence, and now they want the Republicans' case against Biden to be complete and done now. Like when they say, there's no proof, there's a link to this, there's no proof, there's a link to that. Well, that's what an inquiry is for, is it not?
So the way that I would describe this is that it is clear that the two impeachments of President Trump were very, very politically motivated. And I'm going to come back to that in a moment. But as a trial attorney, we have to make our case, and our jury is the American public. I'm only here because I represent 560,000 people in the state of Wyoming. And every decision that I make, I try to make so that it is that I'm carrying out and protecting their interests and the interests of my fellow citizens in this country. This isn't political. This is about protecting, again, the rule of law and equal protection, both of which have really been destroyed over both the Obama administrations and this administration, and even the Trump administration, because of the politicization of the agencies against him. So when we talk about the inquiry, that is to put together the case and present it not only to our fellow congressmen and women, but to the American public and say, do you think that this is sufficient as an impeachable offense? Is this a high crime or misdemeanor? Is this what you think? You want to make sure that people are held accountable. And I'm confident with what I know about the evidence and the information, we're going to be able to make that case. But one of the things I think people need to start looking at, if you remember when they impeached President Trump the first time, they walked in, they threw a bunch of papers on the table. They looked at this Vindman guy, which I can't even imagine the guy has ever had any moral authority whatsoever. He's just a political hack is what he is. And they run in and they throw it on the wall. And they said, this was a quid pro quo, because he asked about the Biden's corruption in the Ukraine. Well, for goodness sakes,
right?
We have a lot of Biden corruption in the Ukraine. If the president of the United States isn't going to do something like what President Trump did to ferret this out, we're done with the rule of law. Why do you think Ukraine scared them like they did, like it did? If he'd been talking to the president of France, I don't think there'd have been any impeachment. If he'd been talking to the head to the head of the Netherlands, I don't think there would have been any impeachment. It was about Ukraine, and they knew that there was so much corruption related to the Bidens and others when it comes to the Ukraine that it totally freaked them out. And again, they had to deflect attention and try to get everybody to look the other way. I was just in a meeting this past week, and almost every 15 minutes, no matter what our subject was, Ukraine would come up. And I finally asked the question, why is it that all roads lead to Ukraine when it comes to these bad acts? What is it about Ukraine that is really kind of controlling the narrative on so many other things right now? And I think we need to be looking into that, because I think there's more.
Well, Congressman, what do you think about, I think there are a lot of folks throughout the party, I don't think I'm one of them, and you're definitely not, but what do you have to say to those people who are kind of, they warn against a tit for tat on this kind of thing, right? Oh, well, you know, you went after Trump, so we're going to go after you. You know, I personally think you got to fight fire with fire, but I'd kind of be interested in hearing, because you represent a state and you're hearing probably these things from people all the time. Kind of, what do you say to someone like that?
We have to present the evidence. So what I encourage people to do is go to the website for the Oversight Committee and just look at the timeline. As a practicing trial attorney, one of the things that I would always use are timelines. I think timelines are an incredibly valuable tool because we relate things to each other. That's how we ferret things out. That's how we understand how this person could relate to this person, could relate to this action, could relate. So go look at that timeline. Start understanding how these documents fit together. Understand the fact, as Tim pointed out, that the president of the United States was apparently using his own grandchildren in sham companies. Who would do that? Who would do that? And so it is up to us. We need to make sure the American people is our jury. The American public is our jury, and we need to present the evidence and we need to present the facts. And I am confident we'll be able to do that.
I want to ask, we're getting close to time here, but I want to ask one thing about the CR and the funding issue that's facing Congress. And I know that Congress adjourned for the weekend and, we'd be back at it in the new week. But is Speaker McCarthy, do you think, are we going to get this not untangled in time to not have a government shutdown? What do you think?
I don't know in terms of the timing of what they can do. The concern is that we spend far too much money, and $33 trillion in debt is unsustainable. An open border is unsustainable. So what I've tried to do, what my priorities have been, is that no matter what we do in terms of this funding mechanism, it has to be tied to HR 2, which is our border security bill. I have really focused on the fact that we cannot continue to bring 10,000 people in a day. We have brought over 10 times the population of my state have crossed that border illegally in just the last year and a half. And it isn't
amazing.
So I focus kind of on the border security side. I believe, I tell people all this time, we don't need to panic. Things get accomplished. We play brinkmanship. Our form of government can be messy. You just need to let some of this play out. And I don't know if there will be a shutdown. If it is, I think that it would be short. But I don't even know. I don't even know about that. That there will be one. What I think is that there are people who are working really, really hard to put together a package that we can present to the Senate. And then it's going to be up to the Senate and the Biden White House as to whether they want to fund the government or they want an open border. They can choose.
Yeah. And then at that point, everybody has to all hands on deck and pin it all on Joe Biden, who wants to keep the border open. Because if it shuts down, it'll be his open border that does it.
Yes.
One last thing. There's a piece of interesting legislation that I know that you're working on. I talked to you about it the other day when I bumped into you. And it, I guess the shorthand way to describe it, everybody knows what term limits are. But usually people think about that in terms of limiting the amount of time that an elected official can stay in office. But you're talking about term limits for an entire new category of people in Washington, D.C. You're talking about limiting the term of employment for federal bureaucrats, right? Tell me about that idea.
So people, there are some people who believe that the solution to all of our ills is to limit the amount of time that legislators, our Congress and state representatives, can be in office. Some states have done that. They've done it by their constitution. Others have passed statutes. So there are people who want to limit the number of years that we can serve in Congress. And their targets are people like Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. And I get that. I don't like them either. But there are already term limits, and it's called the ballot box. People need to get engaged and they can vote. The problem with term limits on our legislative branch is when you look at the Constitution, the legislative branch was always supposed to be the strongest branch because it's the one that is directly elected by the people. We're the ones who are the most accountable. We're the ones who should be the most responsive. I have to run for office every 2 years. I've got to be in Wyoming talking with my constituents. And as I said earlier, carrying out what they want me to do, making sure that I am representing them in Congress, in the halls of Congress. So if you term limit Congress, all you've done is further empowered the bureaucracy and the executive branch at the expense of the very people who represent us. So I'm adamantly opposed to term limits for our legislative branch. But I don't think that I am not as opposed when it comes to our bureaucracy. We have people that have been in some of these agencies for 25, 30 years. You bring in a legislator, and it's pretty difficult to compete with that, I guess you'd say. And especially if you term limit us. You have a congressman or a congresswoman limited to 6 years. How do they take on the bureaucracy of someone been there 25 or 30 years? What I think that we ought to consider doing is that not make it so that they can't be in government service, but limit the amount of time they can work in a particular agency, and then maybe limit the overall time. And I don't know what the number is. That's part of what we're working out, and we're working on the logistics. But it seems to me, if you want to change what goes on in Washington, D.C., limit the power of the bureaucracy. That's the key.
Are you confident that a bill like that, and I know it hasn't been drawn yet, will pass a constitutional muster? What do you think?
We have the ability to hire and fire. The constitutional problem is with our legislative branch, because what it was 30 years ago, it was a big push across the country to impose term limits. And the United States Supreme Court weighed in on that and said the Constitution defines the requirements and the credentials. And so you can't term limit Congress without a constitutional amendment. But I do believe that we could term limit the bureaucracy.
That's interesting. I mean, having worked in a federal agency myself, USDA, I can tell you that there are people there, and you know this, have been there for decades and decades and decades. And very often, this is what, when people talk about the deep state, when President Trump talked about the deep state, that's what it meant to me.
It does to me too.
Right. Entrenched, and they can, through their efforts, they can actually thwart administration policy, because they're the ones who are actually at the levers in the agencies where the policies are implemented, and they can stop it and just sort of like, you know, slow walk things and do all kinds of things to muck up what the president's trying to get done. Is that what you're thinking of?
That's absolutely correct. And that's many of the lawsuits that I have filed have been against the federal government, and they've been against this kind of agency abuse. So I'm intimately familiar with how agencies operate and how they, through regulations and guidance documents and internal standard operating procedures and things, they're the ones that are legislating. And that's where Congress needs to step up and reclaim its rightful authority to legislate and start limiting the power of these administrative agencies. That's probably my biggest passion, is trying to limit the power and authority of unelected bureaucrats, because they're entirely unaccountable to the American public. So that's right. And there are people who've actually studied it. And part of the reason that we have moved so far to the left in this country in terms of policies is they have done statistical analyses. When you have a Democrat president, man, it's all hands on deck, and they are out there pushing forward with whatever that policy is. You have a Republican in office and it's like, whoa, we're done. We're stopping. We're not going to allow him to implement any of his policies. And they were very honest about it during President Trump's tenure, his 4 years. There were public employees that flat said, no, we're not doing that. We don't agree with him. We don't like him. And we're not doing what he says. And they did not carry out his policies.
Yep, I saw that. Kaylin,
we've got some horror stories. I'm sure we could share offline. Yeah. Both. I was at the Treasury in the White House, and I can tell you, in regards to the NSC and then also fiscal policy, there are like people who've been there for 50 years who are just never gonna move. They're gonna die in that office, like holding up anything you can to benefit people's lives. So it's one of those things where you think about how long it takes from something in the White House to transition to normal people. I think this is a really good way of kind of cutting that time, right? You're providing tangible quality of life improvements because of the work that you're doing here on this issue.
Well, Harriet, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to try to be respectful of your time, and we ran a little bit long. So I very much appreciate it. What are you looking forward to as we move on? Some of the stuff's not all that fun, but what is it you're looking forward to in the House?
We're going to solve a lot of problems. We have roadblocks that are up against us. But there is a real, consensus that I'm feeling not only around the country in Wyoming when I go there, but in the halls of Congress as well, that we're running out of runway. And so I do think that things are going to get bad. This inflation, the inflationary pressures are policy driven. And until we change those policies, it's going to be difficult to try to give some relief to the American public. But we've got to make sure that the American public understands that those policies are being dictated by Joe Biden and his radical administration. He needs to be held accountable for what he's done to our energy industries and to affordable energy. And we need to make sure that they know he's the one who's done it. And we need to change the policy. Our very form of government does not make the government the enemy of the people. But the people in positions of power right now in Washington, D.C., in the White House, they kind of view themselves as having the ability and the right to really hurt people, and they are. We need to change that, and there are a lot of people who want to.
Yep, I can see that. And do you ever talk to your counterparts there, your two Wyoming senators, and talk about the inequity, about how you have to cover the entire state all by yourself, and there's two of them?
I haven't discussed that particular topic, but I just talked to Senator Barrasso yesterday, and we have been, the three of us have worked together very well on some extremely important legislation, including trying to block USDA from requiring electronic identification ear tags for livestock, and the COAL Act, as I talked about earlier. So I've got a good working relationship with our senators.
No, I know you do. I was just joking. But Wyoming, you are the at-large House member, which means for listeners, you're the only one. But on the House side, but in the Senate, there's still two of them, because that's, well, actually, it's in the Constitution. So Harriet Hageman, the Congresswoman from the great state of Wyoming, thank you so much for joining us. It has been an honor and a pleasure to talk to you, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you, and I hope to get invited back someday.
Oh, absolutely you will. And Kaylin, thank you.
As always, thank you, guys.
Good to meet you.
This has been the Line Drive Podcast.